Sunday, April 15th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents guitarist-composer Nels Cline. Join us as we find out that there's more to Nels Cline than Wilco and his latest Nels Cline 4 release. That's Sunday, April 15th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Hello, and welcome to Health Action on listener-supported community radio, WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All, and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week, along with Catherine Davis and Bob Lederer. In this week's program, during the first half, I'm going to be doing an interview with the Chair of the Health Committee in the New York State Assembly about various issues the state legislature has been grappling with, healthcare issues this year, particularly in the budget, recently completed budget process, and looking forward to the rest of the session. So stay tuned for that. And Catherine Davis will be here during the second half of the program. But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. Pharmaceutical companies gave at least $116 million to patient advocacy groups in a single year, according to a new database that logs approximately 12,000 donations from large publicly traded drug corporations to nonprofit organizations. The database, called Prescription for Power, shows that donations to patient advocacy groups tallied for the year 2015, the most recent full year in which documents were required by the Internal Revenue Service were available. The amount actually dwarfs the total amount that drug companies themselves spent directly on federal lobbying of Congress and the administration. The first-of-its-kind database compiled by Kaiser Health News tallies the money from big pharma to patient groups. Kaiser Health News examined the 20 pharmaceutical firms that are included in the S&P 500. The database is based on information contained in charitable giving reports from company websites and IRS 990 filings. The 14 companies that contributed $160 million to patient advocacy groups reported only about $63 million in lobbying activities for that same year. Six drug makers, the data show, contributed $1 million or more to individual groups that represent patients who rely on their drugs. The database identifies over 1,200 patient groups. Of those, approximately 600 accepted money from the drug makers in the database. Even as these patient groups grow in number and political influence, their funding and relationships to drug makers are little understood. Unlike payments to doctors and lobbying expenses, drug companies do not have to report payments to these groups. Although these groups' primary missions are to focus on the needs of patients with a particular disease, such as arthritis, heart disease, or various cancers, These patient advocacy groups effectively supplement the work of industry lobbyists perform, providing patients to testify on Capitol Hill and organizing letter writings and social media campaigns that are often beneficial to the pharmaceutical companies. Notably, such groups have been silent or slow to complain about higher escalating drug prices, a prime concern of patients and voters. This overall situation spotlights donations pharmaceutical companies make to patient groups, large and small. The data shows that 15 patient groups with annual revenues as large as $3.6 million relied on the pharmaceutical companies for at least 20% of their revenue, and some relied on them for more than half of their revenue. The database explores only a slice of the pharmaceutical industry's giving overall and will be expanded with more companies and groups over time. The decision by Democrats to take the offensive on health care during this fall's midterm elections marks a switch from tactics in the year 2010 when the party lost 64 seats in the House majority just after passing the Affordable Care Act. To climb back, they need to gain a net 23 seats to win back House control, and the power to block key elements of President Trump's agenda and any further attempts to roll back or repeal the new health care law. Last year's failed Republican repeal and replace attempt gave Democrats a chance to promote popular aspects of the law, including its ban on jacking up rates for patients with pre-existing medical conditions. After years of attack by Republicans, the Affordable Care Act has gained majority public approval in the Gallup poll for the first time in April 2017, about a year ago. A Gallup poll last month found that the cost and availability of health care is still Americans' top issue for the fifth year in a row. While repeated Republican efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act have failed, Congress did vote in December to end a key component of the law starting in 2019, the requirement that all Americans obtain insurance of some kind or pay a special tax penalty. Premiums for 2019 are expected to be announced in October, just before voters head to the polls. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office forecasts a 10% increase for people who buy insurance in the individual market. While the individual market makes up just 7% of how Americans get health insurance, compared to 49% of Americans with employer-sponsored coverage and 35% with public insurance, such as Medicare and Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act still drives the politics of health care for Congress and voters. A bipartisan Senate proposal to stabilize Affordable Care Act marketplaces, sponsored by Republican Lamar Alexander of Tennessee and Democrat Patty Murray of Washington, failed in March over language restricting abortion funding. Democrats plan to make the argument to voters that Republicans should be held responsible for rising insurance costs because they control both chambers of Congress and the White House. However, the biggest shift for the party may be Democrats' willingness now to openly defend the Affordable Care Act in competitive Republican-held districts. And finally, according to a new survey from 2015, nearly every Veterans Administration hospital now offers some kind of alternative health treatment, such as yoga, mindfulness, and art therapy. For example, the Department of Veterans Affairs has given a $120,000 grant to a special wheelchair Tai Chi course. In Mumfreesboro, Tennessee, military veterans in wheelchairs are guided through slow-motion Tai Chi poses as the speaker plays soothing instrumental music. The participants swivel about, face, and continue to the next pose. While the wheelchair Tai Chi provides activities for those who've lost some use of their legs, the exercise program is also geared toward helping regular veterans who have mental health issues, including post-traumatic stress disorder. This idea of going on prescriptions, especially beyond opioid painkillers, has been a key focus of the VA nationally. In Tennessee, nearly a quarter of all VA patients with an active medical prescription were on opioids in 2012. That number has now dropped to 15%, but that's still higher than in most other parts of the country. The Department of Veterans Affairs has been aggressively trying to wean veterans from reliance on strong narcotics, partly by using prescription data as a key measurement to judge VA hospitals across the country, while also trying to make sure alternatives don't cause their own harmful effects. The VA acknowledges that there's very little evidence at this point that Tai Chi or mindfulness therapy or acupuncture will do any good for PTSD or addiction disorders, though recently there has been research into the quality of life benefits of Tai Chi among older adults. However, these alternative therapies have been in use by the VA long enough that the agency claims to more closely track the treatment's effectiveness. Is especially targeting people for alternative treatment who've only recently completed their military service. The goal, proponents say, is to have veterans incorporate these techniques into their weekly routines and not just rely on a drug prescription to ease pain or emotional anxiety. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment, taking a look at health issues before the New York State Legislature this year. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our first segment for this week's program, we're going to be taking a look at healthcare issues before the New York State Legislature this year, 2018. Joining us is Richard Gottfried, who's chair of the Health Committee in the New York State Assembly. Welcome back to Health Action, Assemblymember Gottfried.
Well, good to be with you.
So first of all, of course, we've just finished the budget process. That's the first half of the legislative session, and the number of health issues in that, and we'll kind of go through them one by one by one. But first, let's get a paint a picture for the audience of the overall budget process. How does that play out? What are the phases and steps of it?
Well, we've only got 20 minutes.
Well, New York, from a 50,000-foot view,
yes.
Maybe.
So basically, under the state constitution, the governor submits a budget proposal in roughly January of each year. The state fiscal year begins April 1, so we've got 3 months to respond and negotiate changes, et cetera, if we're going to have the budget ready to go by the start of the fiscal year. We spend January, February, the early part of March, reviewing the governor's budget, developing alternative proposals, which both houses put forth in early March. Advocacy groups of all sorts come to us with their proposals and concerns. And then once both houses have adopted their respective proposals in early mid-March, we then have a very condensed and very intensive period of three-way negotiations among the basically majority parties in the Assembly and Senate and the governor, and that produces a negotiated product that we pass generally on March 31st.
And healthcare is always one of the big issues in the budget. How does it fit into the overall picture?
Well, you know, healthcare, the bulk of which is the Medicaid program, is just under 45% of the entire state budget. Elementary and secondary school education is about the same percentage. So, as I often say, everything else in the budget is almost pocket change. The Medicaid program is always the big negotiating topic in the health part of the budget because it's so huge. Every governor proposes ways to try to cut back on Medicaid spending one way or another. Some years, the governor, whoever the governor is more draconian than in some other years. Fortunately, this year in the Medicaid program was one of the milder years that we've had to deal with over the years. But there were still some issues that could have jeopardized the health care, particularly home care, for a lot of Medicaid recipients.
And this year, going into the budget process, the governor's office identified that they were projecting a $4.5 billion shortfall. In how big a budget, and how did the governor and the legislature sort of grapple with that sort of overall before we get into the details?
Yeah, well, the state budget is over $160 billion this year. That's with a B. About half of that is state tax dollars. The other half is various forms of federal aid and federal matching money. So that $4+ billion was basically applied to the roughly $80 billion, half of the state budget that is state tax dollars. Part of that deficit was, or shortfall was, if you assumed that agency spending would grow faster than in previous years. The governor in his budget cut back on a lot of that agency spending, so that knocked a lot of the deficit down even before the legislature had to deal with it. We then, every year as part of the process, we quote-unquote re-estimate revenues, almost always coming to the conclusion that taxes will bring in more money than the governor projected. We also reanalyze what existing programs will cost, and we almost always agree that things will cost less than the governor proposed or estimated, and that kind of makes things fit.
And this is true under all governors, right? And it's not unique to the current one.
Yeah, you know, I've served under 8 governors. They all use the same training manual and rule book. You know, governors do everything they can usually to try to make it difficult for the legislature to increase spending. Because, you know, if they didn't, the state budget would be probably twice what it is today. Democrats in the legislature always try to raise most items of spending, and the Republicans usually try to cut back on almost all areas of spending except for school aid, particularly to Republican school districts. So it's a well-worn path.
All right, so now let's dig down a little bit into this year's budget process and health issues. What were some of the major issues that were dealt with in the budget this year? There are some perennials, and then there's always some unique ones. Let's start with the perennials. What are those that always kind of have to get negotiated?
Well, for the third year in a row, the governor proposed to take a bunch of individual public health and disease-oriented programs in the health department and that are separately itemized in the budget. And he has, in the past and this year, proposed to lump them together in one lump sum, which reduces the authority of the legislature to decide where the money goes, and then to cut the size of the lump 1 year by 10%, last year by 20%. This year he proposed to cut them again by 20%. In the past, we have undone the lumping together, so the programs were itemized, but in the past we have not been able to come up with the money to restore the funding. This year, fortunately, we were able to not only continue to itemize the spending, but we also restored the 20% cut the governor proposed. You know, in the Medicaid program, the governor's main focus was things dealing with long-term care, particularly home care. And there were several fairly technically written proposals designed to cut back on spending on long-term care. And I'm happy to say that that we were able to reject several of those proposals and modify others to help diminish their negative impact. You know, there were proposals from the governor to cut back on Medicaid spending for over-the-counter drugs, and we stopped that. There were good things that happened. We increased the state spending on capital funding for hospitals and nursing homes and community health centers and the like. We put in $5 million in additional funding for hepatitis C service programs. So there were some good things that we did. One very big item that it's not entirely clear where we left it, and that's the question of the conversion of the Fidelis not-for-profit Medicaid managed care plan. They want to sell the company to a for-profit national insurance company called Centene. Now, when a not-for-profit entity converts to being for-profit, the state will often claim a share of the proceeds from that transaction, particularly here where almost all the value of the Fidelis company comes from Medicaid funding. We will be getting, I think, in the neighborhood of like $3 billion or so from that transaction, which will be spent over a period of years by the state. It is not entirely clear how that money will be spent. The governor had proposed to give him sole authority to spend that money really for any purpose he wanted. Not surprisingly, the legislature said, no, you can't do that. So the money was, you know, is put into a special account, although it is still not entirely clear when and how that money will be spent. So that will continue to be an issue.
Yes, we had we did a whole segment on our program last week about this, where we had some consumer advocates talking about that. So, Listeners, if you want to get more detail, just go to the station's archives page, and you can look up the program and give it a listen if you like. Any other major things that happened?
Well,
there are
a few things that are small in dollar amount, but that I'm very happy about. You know, the legislature, primarily the Assembly, provides funding in the budget every year for something called Consumer Health Advocates, which is a statewide program that is coordinated by the Community Service Society that helps consumers who are trying to figure out the health insurance system. And we significantly bumped up their funding. If I'm remembering correctly, we increased their funding by about $500,000, which was a percentage-wise a fairly hefty increase. We increased funding for school health centers and for the advocacy group that works with the school health centers. We increased funding for a group called the Long-Term Care Community Coalition, which is an advocacy group for people in primarily in nursing homes, and we pretty much doubled the funding that the Assembly provides to that program. They do just amazing work, and there are a couple of organizations like that that I'm very glad we were able to provide additional funding for.
Now, another thing that came up for renewal this year is funding for the navigators that help people enroll in health insurance plans. Was that funding renewed?
Well, a lot of that is, I think you're referring to the Community Health Advocate program. So the navigating of people who are helping to navigate for people who are trying to sign up through the exchange and then figure out what their insurance companies are telling them. We bumped up that funding. It's a program that does an awful lot of good with not very much money.
Great. Okay, so we're through the first half of this year's session. The session usually runs through late June. Now, legislature's on break. You've done the budget. You'll be back in session starting next week. And what's sort of the general picture, and then we can dig into some health issues that may be coming up during that thing. What happens during the second half of the session?
Well, as you said, almost all bills that are not done as part of the budget are voted on during the roughly 2.5 months after we're done with the budget. For example, this and by the way, each year, each house of the legislature passes several hundred bills or more, even though we have divided party control in the legislature, every year several hundred bills pass both houses and end up on the governor's desk, where most of them get signed into law. The things that I'll be doing a lot of my work on, several bills to try to expand the state's medical marijuana program. We will, I assume, be shortly passing for the fourth year in a row the New York Health Act, our single-payer bill, a bill that I think is pretty important. Whether it will get to the assembly floor, let alone the Senate, we'll see, is the bill to allow what is called medical aid in dying in New York, which has been enacted in several other states, that would allow a mentally competent New York adult with a terminal illness to request and be prescribed medication to end their life, as I said, where they are suffering from a terminal illness. It's a bill about which there is a lot of hot debate. The Health Committee will be holding public hearings on April 23rd in Albany and on a date in May in New York City. And I think that's going to be a very important issue that I hope we can make some progress on.
What has been, circling back to one of the issues you identified, the medical marijuana program here in New York, it's fairly new. It seems to me that it got off to a fairly limited start and has been slowly, with pushing from you and Senator Sabino in the Senate, expanding out. Where does all that stand now?
Well, you're right that when the medical marijuana law was passed back in June of 2014, Governor Cuomo insisted on language that limited the bill in many ways, and the first round of regulations that were issued by the health department were very tight restrictions on the program. I thought much too restrictive. But I'm very pleased that in the last year or so, the administration seems to have quite dramatically turned a corner on medical marijuana, and the regulations they've been enacting in the last year and a half have all helped to significantly opened the program. And my sense from talking to people in the administration is that they are also open to a lot of the legislative changes that Senator Savino and I have been talking about to try to open the program even more. You know, for example, medical marijuana is the only medication that I know of where the law limits what conditions it can be used for. And so one bill that I've been pressing for would eliminate that list of conditions and let your doctor or other healthcare provider decide whether medical marijuana can treat your condition as your doctor can with any other medication. We have also been requiring every what is called a registered organization, which is the entities that can produce and sell medical marijuana. So far, the health department has required all of those registered organizations to handle the whole process of the product, from planting the seeds to dispensing to an individual patient. There's no other area of in our economy where we require that kind of what economists call vertical integration. Actually, in many areas of our economy, we prohibit that on an antitrust basis. So I will be pressing for legislation that would clearly allow a registered organization to work on one or more parts of that process if that's what they choose. You know, a company may be very good at running a greenhouse, but not know the first thing about how to run a retail operation. And they shouldn't have to know how to do both.
And in our last minute, let me just ask, this is an election year, so as we approach the fall, things are going to get more political. What's the political overlay of the rest of the session look like?
Oh, my goodness.
In a minute.
I could have answered that question one way about a week ago. Now that the Independent Democratic Caucus, so-called, has left their coalition government with the Republicans in the Senate and have come back to join the mainstream Democrats, you know, they only have 29 seats between them. It takes 32 to be a majority. We may get two of those seats in the April 24th special elections. And then the question is, does Simca Felder in Brooklyn, who has been in a coalition with the, who has been part of the Republican conference, would he come back to the Democratic conference, which would give them a bare 32 vote majority? So it's not at all clear what the rest of the legislative session is going to look like.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We've been getting a really good overview on health issues before the state legislature this year, 2018, both in their just completed budget process and looking forward for the rest of the session through late June. Our guest has been Richard Gottfried, who's chair of the Health Committee in the New York State Assembly. Thank you so much for joining us on Health Action, Assemblymember Gottfried.
Thanks for having me on.
And we'll be back with our second segment in a moment with Catherine Davis. Stay tuned. Thanks to Reggie Johnson for editing and engineering this part of the program. I'm Mark Hannay.
Welcome. Joining me now is Jody Sirota. Jody is a life-changing metaphysical educator, channel, vibrational healer, and professional artist. Her in-depth intuitive abilities and her remarkable sound healing powers are used to create initiations and activations that instantly make major shifts in consciousness and healing. She holds individual channeled sessions, teaches classes, and creates multimedia concerts and events for personal growth, transformation, and the creative process. She is a co-author of the book Healing the Heart of the World from Elite Books, and she is also the owner and creator of MetaCenter New York. And as well, for this very event that we are speaking about today, Jody Sirota is one of the creators of this event, doing it in partnership with Planet Heart and We the World. The event itself is the annual World Peace Earth Day celebration, and it is taking place on Saturday, April 21st, 6:30 to 9:45 p.m. You might want to get there early at 6 p.m. The doors open up. The New York Church, 114 East 35th Street. That's in New York City. And you can get ticket information at planetheart.org. The advance cost is a savings to the at-door cost, but you can make that choice for yourself. But let's go back, and I want to make sure that we get connected, Jody. Not everyone has heard you, though you've been on the program several times. But you have a long history here in New York of creating spaces for people to make these connections with your work with the MetaCenter New York. Can we give people some introduction, if brief, about your work and that commitment you've been bringing for many, many years now?
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on your show. It's good to talk to you again. I've been doing my work for many, many years, over 30-something years, and I was guided many, many years ago when I was about 19 years old, which is even earlier than that, to something shifted in my consciousness at that time just because of an event that took place in my life. The event wasn't so great, but it actually brought me into a whole new level of consciousness. And at that point, I was guided to know that my work, other than being an artist, my background is painting. And now at this point, I do painting with the purpose of visual vibration for healing. So my work was all became about consciousness raising and healing, personal growth and creativity. And so a lot of my work, I opened up really fully, and I was always interested in all this work, but not because I thought I was going to be doing it, but it became something that became a mission. And I opened up and became a channel where I started to channel in all sorts of high beings, high guides that were from higher dimensions, and always for the purpose, again, of consciousness raising and healing and personal growth. And what happened is, through the process, I was guided to do individual channeled Akashic record readings, which are the readings of your soul. It's like a library of your soul that I tap into, that my guides tap into, and they bring through guidance about how to understand what you're here for and your gifts, and helping you to bring forth more of who you are in your higher consciousness and living a higher conscious living, as well as being expressive in your life and clearing any karmic patterning. And so I still do that, and I also got guided to create all sorts of events. A lot of my work is about bringing people together. I mean, on the planet, there's so much going on that seems to be confusing to people at this time especially. The work that I do helps to sort of bring some kind of clarity within them in relation to who they are in relation to being on this planet as humans in physical form. And there's a whole time period now with the ascension process, which I can explain in a second. But my work also became, as I was doing my work, sound started coming through me when I used to do hands-on healing work, which I don't do as much anymore. But sound would come through and information would come through me, and sounds from other dimensions. And then these light languages, I still work with ancient crystal skulls. There's one called Max, the ancient crystal skull. I put my hands on that, and that ignited me to awaken to a whole other level of something else that was these languages of light that come through and help to awaken people and activate your codes of consciousness. So everything I do is always about bringing people into a higher level of their consciousness and being able to express that in this life and hopefully enjoy being human, you know, being spirit in human form. And so a lot of what's gone on the planet now is all about ascension. And only four times in history where we've had this alignment with stargates and things of that nature with the Earth, so that it opens up a space for all these transmissions of light to come through and love to awaken our hearts to be connected to everything. So through that whole process, I just started gathering people, and they told me I was going to create a center, which I did, the Meta Center, Multidimensional Education and Transformational Arts Center, which my guides gave me that name. And it was a true metaphysical center for about 9.5 years, and then they raised our rent and we had to close. But I'm still looking for the possibility of going to another venue, but looking for support financially to create that at this point. So all of these things keep bringing me to new levels of my own consciousness and helping other people with the same. And the need for that at this time is really about gathering people together and doing the things like you're doing at this time of bringing people, you know, connecting to many people through all your shows that you're doing. And Andrew and I are doing, Educate and I are doing this show together for the Earth Day and World Peace celebration. So it's all about connecting, being here, being on the earth, being in our bodies, keeping our hearts open for connection through unity, unified consciousness through an open heart. A long answer to your first question there.
No, it's beautiful because I think we are learning to think and speak, communicate, and understand our reality in this sort of quantum way. And so, you know, I could ask a question that could have multiple implications. So I think it's great that you are responding in an expansive way. What I'd like for you to do also is to make that question, that connection, because you work on this level of energy. And sometimes people don't understand that we are ourselves multidimensional. We have spirit guides, but in a way we can think of our guides as our relations, sort of like your uncle, your aunt, your spirit guide.
Right.
And so that's how I kind of look at these things.
Hopefully support systems.
Yeah. And so, but also, you know, that the fact that we're living on an earth that's alive and has an energy and a consciousness, and how we can just expand ourselves through making these connections and being willing to be open to the messages that are coming through. So, for instance, as you say, you have messages coming through you for people who might not understand what that means. Maybe you could put into the context of our multidimensional selves.
Well, I work multidimensionally. That means understanding that we're here on the earth, but this is only this is how I understand it, as from my own experience, but that we are first spirit. We're first, I look at it as God consciousness, if people can use universal, cosmic, whatever words you want to use, but that we're etheric beings. We're actually energy. We're physical, spiritual beings that are incarnating at this particular time on the planet into physical existence. And so that we actually do, we also have a higher part of ourselves, even in the human form, that still exists, that's part of the greater whole of consciousness. So as if there's a greater, and I think of it as vibration or energy, because that's exactly what it is, even scientifically. It's been proven we are molecules vibrating a certain frequency, and as you keep awakening your consciousness, I do it through meditation. Other people might do it through chanting. Other people might do it just through being kind-hearted, mm-hmm. just being open to being there for themselves and other people, being nurturing and open. But through meditation for me, and also through working with sound through my voice, I bring through these higher frequencies that come through, but I also work with, I have particular guides, and I work with many guides. Some people work with one guide. It's like having your own, I can't think of the word, but just like, you know, you're having helpers. And some people also bring through, I do this as well, bring through people who have passed on, I believe, in all the different dimensions and different time frames in past lives, and that everything affects us in how we are today, how we view through a lens of what's gone on with ourselves through different incarnations. So for me, what's happened is I expanded and opened at some point. It's like my heart opened and my whole, it's like a conduit for higher dimensional beings to come through me and speak through me and give information for myself and for other people for higher reasons, for, to understand themselves that they are, we are here in this particular experience, and also being here with the Earth, that there's a particular alignment on the planet or with the planet of these stargates that aligns a particular way of having energy transmitted to the planet as well as to all the inhabitants of the planet. Mm-hmm. So as we're coming into ourselves more, we're even opening whether we're even consciously aware of it. I believe that there's a higher conscious choice that we made before we even got here, knowing we'd be on the planet while all these changes were taking place, and we would be part of that in some way. And some people are doing the kind of work that you and I are doing in different ways to just awaken people. Other people are being in their regular day-to-day existence, but their presence affects people. We all affect, everyone affects something. Everybody makes a difference by being here. Like when someone leaves by dying, we feel that we're missing them. We miss them in their lives. They've made a difference in our lives. So, but the ascension process, I just wanted to talk about that because people, a lot of people, spiritual people, are talking about the idea of ascension. It's a time of becoming aware of ourselves as higher conscious beings that have all the gifts of whatever we would perceive as God or higher consciousness, to have all those gifts within ourselves while on the planet and understanding the, and embodying the fullness of being here as spirit in physical form and hopefully enjoying the journey of being here. But also we make a difference by expressing ourselves, which full empowerment is really full expression of self. But this whole process of ascension, people are awakening and opening and expanding their sensory perceptions. They're becoming more intuitive. They're becoming more able to, they're heightening their awareness just by being here, especially at this time on the planet. There's a lot of things happening because of the timing, this divine timing for all these changes. So right now on the planet, there's so many changes taking place that everybody's getting upset because so much is coming up for people to kind of clear out the past stuff that has not really been in alignment with a higher vibration of consciousness. So we can't, it's like you can't take the darkness and be in the light at the same time. If we open our hearts, the compassion for everyone to be able to kind of move together as a whole, as a collective, through compassion and love and all-inclusiveness. I think of love as a vibration of all-inclusiveness. The more we open our hearts, the more we kind of go together rather than having people be behind us or competitiveness. But there's so much going on the planet right now where so much of the old stuff is kind of coming up to be released or to be recognized, to understand something about it and then let go of it so that we can just kind of move to a much higher level. It's like getting the awareness of polarities of different patterns, where one point you're on one side of a pattern, the other then on the other. If you open your heart and sort of have compassion for being on both sides of the situations, it can lift you in wholeness to a whole other level, which is fifth dimensional consciousness, which is the opening of the heart for unity consciousness, goodness for all. So we're going through this whole kind of thing of ascension. Usually means to, as related to death. We usually, people talk about in the Bible and all these things of, you know, in the past, I'm not religious, but, you know, they talk about people ascending and coming into these higher levels of consciousness, understanding things more about what their lives, what they could get from their lives in human form, having learned lessons to be able to go to these, the higher understanding, having a bigger picture after you die, and kind of, in a sense, looking down, in a sense, and seeing the bigger picture of who you are in relation to everything. But ascension now is more about staying on the planet, and the death, there's still a death in relation to ascension, but the death is about the karma, things that we've experienced in past lifetimes, past experiences, even in this lifetime, of effects of circumstances and how we perceived ourselves because of those circumstances. So we're moving through like a lens that we're, it's almost like clearing a lens, and kind of, it's like when you're at the eye doctor, they give you a different lens to see clear, more clearly. Mm-hmm. We're coming into a higher level of clarity by moving through the old to kind of come into this higher understanding, but still staying on the planet and having all these higher gifts of availability to ourselves. And there were people like, supposedly like Christ and Krishna and Buddha, that lived like that on the planet without having to go to another dimension to be, and we even die, to be able to become that. We're here now to have the opportunity to have that while we're still, it's like another life within the same lifetime. So it's confusing to people because so much stuff is coming up for people that they see the world as really chaotic. But in a sense, at a higher level, I believe that we're coming into a higher level by having to finally awaken and open up all the things that have not been paid attention to, so that it can be looked upon as something we can learn from and move beyond that, but still stay here and then live, like walk the earth in the way that some of these past beings of masters have done in the past. And this is a year that it, numerologically, if you add 2018, it actually comes out to an 11, and 11 is considered in numerology a master number. Mm-hmm. So we're here to become the masters that we have always been, and trying to remember that.
Excellent. And for people who are connecting to what you're talking about, Jody is one of the creators, actual presenters of the annual World Peace Earth Day celebration, and that's Saturday, April 21st, 6:30 to 9:45 p.m. We recommend you get there early. Doors open at 6. The New York Church, 114 East 35th Street in New York. There is an advance door, and also you can do cash at the door. With the advance, you save a little bit. You can go to planetheart.org to find out more, or you can call 212-222-5432, 212-222-5432. So we're a little short on time at this moment, Jody, but I would love for you to give a few words about what you're going to be doing on this day, but also to give people a contact website or some way that they can connect with you directly if they choose to.
Okay, my website is www.jodisarota.com, jodisarota.com. You can sign up on my mailing list on my website. It also talks about the work that I do. But at the event, I'm excited to do this. I've done this with Andy Kane for many, many years. And so we have really great speakers and collaborative collaboration of putting everything together. But my work I'm going to be doing, I'm going to channel for the group. No, we don't have a lot of time because we have a lot of speakers. But, and then I'm going to work with sound, vibrational sound healing and activations to awaken people's consciousness and to help them to kind of come into themselves more and accept that higher conscious choice I was talking about, that it was a good, right, and safe choice, before they got here, so that they can really accept all their feelings and knowing that they know what they're doing here, and there's a way to hopefully enjoy being here while all this, all these things are taking place in transformations. So it should be exciting, and we have a lot of great speakers that are going to be there, and there's going to be experiential things and music and all sorts of talks. So it should be a really good time, and I work off the group that's present, though, so I have sort of an idea of what I'm going to do, and then I just work off it and channel it through the whole thing.
Excellent. So people will be having that direct connection, not just with you, but with the spirit realm. Thank you so much for joining me today, Jody Sirota, and we will connect again.
Thank you.
And
thank you for doing your work. It's been really powerful for you to be out there doing what you're doing and affecting people and bringing so many people out there to speak, as well as the work that you do on your own. So thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and take care, and we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Uçarlar yaşı şu ana Engedi kendim kıyla Doğula Koran rekan Elta kimde kozikla Panedim madar Aki el horca Bay bey Dışarlarım
Greetings, Malika Lee Whitney inviting you to tune in for a special broadcast of Untitled, framing important issues as they relate to arts, education, and activism. Guests will share experiences within their respective fields, and we'll invite your thoughts as well. The special will be a two-part edition of Untitled, broadcast on Saturday, April 14th and Saturday, April 28th from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Please continue to support listener-sponsored WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM, New York. For more information on the easy ways that you can contribute, check our website at WBAI.org. Thank you.
On Sunday, April 15th at 11 p.m., Sugar My Bowl presents guitarist, composer, Nels Cline. Join us as we find out that there's more to Nels Cline than Wilco and his latest Nels Cline 4 release. That's Sunday, April 15th at 11 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
We cannot be silent. Two of the most extreme militarists just joined the Trump administration, Mike Pompeo and John Bolton. These right-wing hawks are the most strident forces calling for war with Iran and North Korea and new attacks on Palestine. We must challenge escalating U.S. wars at home and abroad. Resist these ominous appointments, the raids and roundups of our immigrant and Muslim sisters and brothers, the cutbacks in every social program, and the escalating racism and police violence. That's Sunday, April 15th at 2 p.m. Join a New York City rally at Herald Square, 34th Street and 6th Avenue. Following the rally, a march to Trump Tower.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And this is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. And, wow, you know what kind of a show I have prepared for you? If so, tell me, because I don't. But it'll be fun, so stay tuned. And yes, there will be Facebook Live. I'm just slow.
To thee by the moonlight, who held should bar the way. was upright in the stirrups. He scarce could reach a hand, but she loosened her hair in the casement. His face burned like a brand, as a black cascade of perfume came tumbling over his breast. And he kissed its waves in the moonlight, oh, sweet waves in the moonlight. He tugged at his rein in the moonlight and galloped away to the west. Gypsy's ribbon looping the purple wood. A ragged troop came marching, marching, marching. King George's men came marching up to the olden door. They said no word to the landlord, they drank his ale instead. But they gagged his daughter and bound her to the foot of her narrow bed. Two of them knelt at a casement with muskets at the side. There was death at every window, hell at one dark window. For Bess could see through the casement the road that he would ride. They had tied her up to attention with many a sniggering jest. They had bound a musket beside her with a barrel beneath the breast. Now keep good watch, and they kissed her. She heard the dead man say, look for me by the moonlight, watch for me by the moonlight. I come to thee by the moonlight, though hill should bar the way. She twisted her hands behind her with all the knots here good. She writhed her hands till her fingers were wet with sweat and blood. They stretched and strained in the darkness, and the hours crawled by like years. To now on the stroke of midnight, called on the stroke of midnight. The tip of her finger touched it, the trigger at least was hers. Were they deaf, they did not hear. Down the ribbon of moonlight, over the brow of the hill, the highwayman came riding, riding, riding. The redcoats looked to the priming, she stood up straight and still. Tod lot in the frosty signs, tod lot in the echoing night. Nearer came and nearer, her face was like a light. Her eyes grew wide for a moment, she drew in a lusty breath. Then her finger moved in the moonlight, her musket shot at the moonlight. Shattered her breast in the moonlight, and wound him with a dare. He turned his spur to the west, he did not know she stayed. But with her head of the musket, drenched with her own red blood. Not till the dawn he hooted, his face could play to hear. Ah, there's the landlord's daughter, the landlord's black-eyed daughter, had watched for her love in the moonlight and died in the darkness there. And back he spurred like a madman, shrieking a curse to the sky, with a white road smoking behind him and his Arabia brandished high. Blood red were the spurs of the golden moon, wine red was his velvet coat. When they shot him down on the highway, down like a dog on the highway, and he lay in his blood on the highway, A highwayman comes riding, riding